So I'd also like to thank the organizers for giving me the chance to speak here. I'm going to talk about something that's very related to a couple of the talks this morning, especially what Gurudev Dutt just talked about, in particular hyperfine coupling between electron spins and nuclear spins in solids. The specific system that we're interested in Basel, because Daniel Loss is the head of our group, is this Loss-DiVincenzo proposal for quantum computing with electron spins confined to quantum dots, usually in semiconductor materials, typically gallium arsenide, because this is a material that you use to make the best gated quantum dots. And the main sources of decoherence in these systems are spin-orbit coupling, so coupling between the electron spin and the orbital wave function of the system, which can then in turn couple to fluctuations in the environment, in particular phonons. Although this mechanism has been shown to be fairly weak in both experiments and theory, so early theory by Kaetsky and Nazarov shows that this mechanism for spin flip is suppressed in low magnetic fields, like the fifth power of the magnetic field, and in for small dots, so large orbital energies, h bar omega zero, like the fourth power. And further theory by Golovach and Loss shows that the dephasing time is in fact limited by the relaxation time, so that the time scale for a decay of the transverse spin is just twice the time scale for decay of the Z component of spin, if you neglect all higher order coupling terms, so leading order in the spin-orbit interaction, and neglecting all other possible dephasing mechanisms. This means that you just have to worry about the longitudinal decay time for spin-orbit coupling. The longitudinal decay time for spin-orbit coupling has been measured in a field of 8 tesla to be on the order of 1 millisecond, and now even at fields on the order of 1 to 2 tesla to be on the order of 100 milliseconds. The typical gating times in quantum dots can be on the order of 50 to 100 picoseconds, so this is really not the major source of decay in the system, it turns out, and this is not a major obstacle to performing coherent operations, many coherent operations within a decay time. However, the hyperfine interaction, which is the coupling of the electron spin to all of the nuclear spins in the surrounding lattice, is in fact an intrinsic decay mechanism. So all isotopes of gallium and arsenic and gallium arsenide carry non-zero nuclear spin 3 halves, and so all of these spins can contribute to a potential dephasing of the electron spin. So this is a mechanism that cannot be suppressed with reducing the temperature or by choosing a nice quantum dot geometry, which you can do to some extent with a spin-orbit interaction plus phonons. One option for eliminating this source of decoherence is just to choose materials from which you would fabricate your quantum dots that have no nuclear spin. So if the materials have no nuclear spin, then they can't couple via the hyperfine interaction, and you have no need to worry about hyperfine-induced dephasing. Some groups that have pursued this are, for instance, on the left I've shown a gated quantum dot in silicon germanium, and in principle, so silicon also contains some isotopes, silicon-29, that have nuclear spin, and germanium also contains one isotope that has nuclear spin, but there are many isotopes that have no nuclear spin, and there are isotopically purified materials available, so you can order them from companies. The problems with these materials is that typically, until now, there has not been so much success in creating gated quantum dots for just materials fabrication issues. I think it's not a fundamental reason, as far as I understand. Another alternative which looks very promising is carbon nanotube quantum dots. And so this is a picture from the University of Basel group. There are other groups in Harvard and in Delft and in Sweden now that have produced these gated double quantum dots. So you take a carbon nanotube, you stretch it, or you just drop a bunch of carbon nanotubes on the surface of a substrate, and then you look for these with an atomic force microscope. When you find them, you can put gates on them. And when you gate them, you can generate a kind of confining potential which allows you to couple electron spins independently in one dot and the other. And in this recent work, we collaborated with some experimentalists in Basel to show that, in fact, the tunnel coupling that you get due to these two coupled electrons in two independent quantum dots can be actually very large, on the order of hundreds of micro EV, which is about a factor of 10 larger than what you usually get in gallium arsenide gated quantum dots. So what are other strategies? If you need to rely on gallium arsenide or other materials, indium arsenide, any 3-5 material, in fact, has a non-zero nuclear spin. If you need to rely on one of these 3-5 materials for quantum computing or for quantum dot quantum computing, then you really have to worry about the hyperfine interaction. And the question is, how can you reduce this hyperfine interaction? So one method that has been suggested is to polarize the nuclear spins. Polarizing the nuclear spins reduces the fluctuations in the environment because the polarized state in some sense is non-degenerate. You have only one way of making a state where you have a ferromagnetic coupling of, or sorry, a ferromagnetic ordering of all of the nuclear spins. And part of this reasoning was motivated by the observation in this paper by Burkhardt et al. That the spin flip time in the presence of the hyperfine interaction, or sorry, the spin flip probability, a probability of going from electron spin up to electron spin down in the presence of n nuclear spins with polarization p, goes like 1 over p squared. So if I make polarization 1, then the spin flip probability goes to 1 over n, which is very small. It's on the order of 10 to the minus 5. So maybe this is within the reach of quantum error correction. And there are nice experimental proposals for really pumping the nuclear spins in these gallium arsenide quantum dots to very high levels, such as this one by Atashi Momoglu and collaborators. And so these look promising, but right now the record is on the order of 60% for the polarization of the single quantum dot. And although there are lots of groups that look like they're very close to making substantial progress in this region, it turns out that polarization is not very effective for removing dephasing. So you can remove the spin flip probability, but the dephasing goes as a different power of p, and I'll tell you about that in just a second. So an alternative solution is to use spin echo pulses. Spin echo pulses allow you, in effect, to reverse the effect of the hyperfine interaction in a large magnetic field, because the Hamiltonian changes sign on a pi pulse. So if I apply a pi pulse to the electron spin, because in a large magnetic field, the coupling is essentially proportional to Sz, if I apply a pi pulse to the electron spin, then it switches the value, the sign of Sz, and it switches the sign of the Hamiltonian, so you get effectively the time reverse dynamics. So this is very good if you want to use electron spins as a quantum memory. Because if I apply a pi pulse, I can recover the state of the system after some later time, and then possibly use it for whatever kind of quantum information implementation I want to do. The problem with the spin echo pulses is that I still have to perform my quantum operations in a time scale given by this free induction decay time for a single electron spin. There is a classical argument that goes that for a single electron spin, you don't expect a free induction decay time that it's much shorter than the spin echo decay time. However, this relies on a classical assumption. It relies on the assumption that you have a classical magnetic field that is different at the site of every electron spin, and each electron spin processes in a different magnetic field. For the hyperfine interaction, you have an effective quantum field, which is built up from a sum of many quantum operators, these nuclear spins, and in fact, in general, this is not true, that you don't get a short single spin free induction decay time. So you still have to perform gating operations within the free induction decay time, which is quite short, on the order of nanoseconds for hyperfine interaction. Okay, so what can you do that removes or that increases this free induction decay time and removes the effect of the hyperfine interaction? What we suggest is preparing the environment through measurement. So I'll describe what I mean a little bit further in a second. And this preparation through measurement of the nuclear spin system would in principle extend the free induction decay time as well as this intrinsic spin echo decay time and also this spin flip probability. And so it would be one potentially very good way to extend the coherence times in these systems if you have to rely on them with nuclear spin. So here's the picture that I give for. So the Hamiltonian we consider is just an electron spin which has some Zeeman interaction. It also has some coupling to many nuclear spins in the surrounding environment on the order of 10 to the 5. The coupling to each nuclear spin is of the Heisenberg type, S dot I, for the Fermi contact interaction, multiplied by a coupling constant, AI, which is position dependent. So the coupling constant depends on the absolute value squared of the wave function. This is like the probability of finding the electron at the position of the nucleus. There are further corrections to this Hamiltonian involving dipole-dipole coupling and nuclear quadrupolar splitting, but these corrections are much, much smaller than the typical size of the hyperfine interaction, so we neglect those to leading order. To approach this problem, it's convenient to just apply a large magnetic field, because the Hamiltonian looks quite simple, but it can be very difficult to evaluate the dynamics in general. You break the Hamiltonian up into a piece that commutes with the SZ component of the electron and a piece that does not commute. The piece that does not commute is usually called the flip-flop term by NMR people. So in a large enough magnetic field, because the Bohr magneton is so much larger than the nuclear magneton, you don't conserve energy with these spin-flip processes, and you can consider just H0 without worrying about V and perform a perturbative solution. And at zeroth order in this perturbative solution, what you get is the following. So if you just calculate the transverse component of spin, you start in whatever transverse component you want, say Sx, and the dynamics of this S plus operator turn out to be given by just a trace over the nuclear spin system. Rho I of 0 is the nuclear spin density matrix, times a frequency term. And the frequency term gives you the decay. Because there is a trace over, in general, many, many different eigenvalues of this operator Hz. So in general, if you take a randomized nuclear spin distribution, the central limit theorem tells you that you end up with a Gaussian distribution of Hz eigenvalues in the limit of large n, which gives you a Gaussian decay because this thing on the right is essentially just a Fourier transform of the nuclear spin state with this frequency. Okay, the Gaussian decay happens on a time scale that goes like 1 over the square root of 1 minus p squared. And this gives you the polarization dependence. So the dependence on the polarization of the nuclear spin system for the decay time of the transverse components of electron spin. And this time scale, if I want to raise it by an order of magnitude, by a factor of 10, I need a polarization on the order of 99%. This means it's very difficult to extend this decay time just by polarizing the nuclear spins. So we suggest this alternative method, which is to narrow this distribution of eigenvalues in this nuclear spin state. And how do you narrow this distribution of eigenvalues? You do this with a measurement in principle. And we suggested this in this paper in PRB in 2004, that you could just perform some kind of measurement on this using electron spin resonance, for instance. You can measure the energy of the system. You measure the position of an electron spin resonance line. This tells you immediately the value of the effective magnetic field. And the value of the effective magnetic field gives you the value of this operator Hz. There are a lot of other works that extend this picture and go into much more detail. There's something by Geza Gidka and co-workers on quant pH, where they analyze the problem in terms of a phase estimation technique. There's some further work that we did on double quantum dots, and there's also work by Guido Burkhard, Dmitry Stepanenko on actually doing this with optical techniques. Okay, so now let's just go to double dots. So if I have double dots, then I have the same picture that I had before, but there are two of them. In addition, I have two orbital states, so not just one confined lowest ground state orbital, and I can jump between the two. If I can hop between the two orbital states, then I end up with a Heisenberg exchange, the standard Hubbard model. And in a large magnetic field, I can again get an effective Hamiltonian. So in this case, the effective Hamiltonian is a little bit different. So if I write the Hamiltonian in terms of pseudospin, singlet and triplet, triplet is pseudospin up, singlet is pseudospin down, then I have an exchange which splits these two states, and I have some difference in the nuclear field along the z direction which couples the two states. So the difference in the if there's a non-zero difference in the nuclear field in the z direction, then I effectively rotate the I apply an x magnetic field and I rotate between singlet and triplet. And if I have just exchange, then I rotate in the XY plane. Okay, and you can calculate this correlator, which gives you the probability of finding a spin triplet if you start in a spin singlet state. And this correlator shows an interesting power law decay, one over t to the 3/2, and in addition, a phase shift, which we found quite interesting. Okay, but the important thing is that you can extend the decay time of this correlator by reducing the width of the fluctuations in this variable the same way that you can for the single spin case. So the fluctuations are characterized by this standard deviation sigma 0. Okay, so now for double dots, what do we suggest? We suggest that you can, because you can change J by changing the voltage bias, so the difference in voltages on dot 1 and dot 2. If you imagine in the Hubbard model, usually you have a T squared over U for J because you have two hopping terms and one energy cost. And the energy cost is really just the bias plus the on-site repulsion energy for a double quantum dot. So I can change J by changing the voltage bias, which I can do fairly quickly in an experiment, which means I can generate some kind of ACJ. And by analogy with a single spin, if I look at this pseudospin picture, then this AC field in this direction will generate Rabi oscillations if I go on resonance with this difference. So this is just an analogy to this ESR proposal that we had before for single electron spins extended to the case of a really experimentally realizable double quantum dot that has been proven in experiments to work. And so basically you have fluctuations in this quantity, which is the difference in the hyperfine fields on the two dots. And this broadens the effective resonance. So for each specific nuclear field, you would end up with one Lorentzian resonance line, which has a width given by the amplitude of oscillation of this exchange. But this set of Lorentzians is, in effect, a superposition which is given by a Gaussian envelope with width sigma 0. Okay? And so the idea now is to just perform a measurement sequence on the electron spin, and through the measurements of the electron spin, you gain information about the nuclear spins. In effect, you map out this resonance line shape, and when you map out the resonance line shape, you know where the resonance was, so you know what the nuclear field is. Okay, so the idea is that you have a nuclear spin which is static between measurements, and the reason for this is that the nuclear spin diffusion time is very long. So the nuclear spin diffusion time measured in gallium arsenide for donors is on the order of seconds. And so we expect that you can perform many, many measurements on the electron spin before the nuclear spins do anything, in which case if this is your initial Gaussian distribution of the nuclear spin system, then as you perform measurements, you can go ahead and just project onto the density matrix of the full system with a given measurement at a given time. And what I write here is the nuclear spin density matrix giving the probability of finding a particular hyperfine field at a given energy. And up here, so this is the density matrix conditional on a certain measurement outcome. So on the left, I have a measurement outcome, which is the unlikely probability, which is the probability the likely probability, which is up, down. And this is the unlikely one, which is the probability of down, up. If I measure down, up, then I know that I found the resonance, because I performed this experiment basically anywhere within this Gaussian distribution. It takes me on the order of sigma over j measurements, on the order of 10 measurements, in order to find the resonance. Once I find the resonance, then I know it is there. And as I keep measuring, if I measure right at the resonance, then I narrow the distribution and I determine more and more information about the nuclear spins. So here's just the probability of finding, sorry about the notation here, this is the probability of finding this down up as a function of number of measurements. And you can see that it goes up as you hit the resonance, and you can narrow a little bit further. And I'll just put up the summary now. And thank you for your attention.